Junior Timmel provided some lively debates which we're covering on agenda, as well as some excellent questioning by Junior Timmel members of ministers and department members. Manx Radio was there to record the whole sitting, and on Perspective this week we'll hear the first 50 minutes of the hour and 8 minute long question time. Questions covered housing, tax, education, health and the environment, and the questioners did a great job in pinning down the government. Sadly, we'll not fit all the question time into this programme, despite me editing out some of the repetitive thanks to Mr. President, but I'm hoping to cover these on a future programme. President Skelly has now taken his seat, so I'll leave you in his capable hands.
Now, honourable members, the order paper before us has three items, and our first item is questions, and we move to our question paper for oral answer. And the question one, I call upon the honourable member for Glenfavor and Peel, Mr. Rothwell Hesketh.
Thank you.
What is the government doing to develop the younger generation's sense of community and cohesion?
I call on Ursula Bishop, Chief Minister, to reply.
Thank you, Mr. President. Our younger generations are the island's future, and supporting their development is vital. The government is committed to ensuring the island is a safe, prosperous place where young people can grow, succeed and feel proud to be part of our thriving Manx community. Young people are central to the island plan's 5 priorities, and the government wants to ensure they have a voice in society. The upcoming Child First policy, due for completion by October 2025, will help young people influence decisions that affect them. We are proud to be one of the few places allowing voting from the age of 16, empowering youth to participate in democracy. Community teamwork and providing opportunity are at the core of youth engagement. The Department for Education, Sport and Culture offers young people accessible ways to connect, discover interests and excel through volunteering, the Manx Youth Games, Kensington Arts or the Manx Language. Youth Services alone hosts over 100 sessions each week across 65 clubs. And in school settings, children and young people have multiple opportunities to learn about and contribute to their communities, including through programmes relating to employability and financial literacy, giving children, students the chance to meet and interact with members of the business community and charities such as Junior Achievement Island Man. Schools also offer opportunities where students, predominantly of sixth form age, can work with organisations such as Nobles Hospital, the Southern Befrienders or charities, and third sector organisations through schemes such as the One World Charity Challenge or Duke of Edinburgh's Award Scheme. We see very much our schools as they exist, as part and heart of our communities, both physically and holistically. There are a number of other initiatives that are pursued, but I must assure the Honourable Member that Government remains committed to investing in initiatives that empower our island's youth.
Supplementary, Mr. Connell.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. It's my experience that the majority of young people do not know they can vote from 16. So what is the Minister doing to ensure that that knowledge is better communicated in the future?
Chief Minister to reply.
Well, thank the Honourable Member for highlighting that fact to me. What I will ensure, actually, given the now quite short period of time between today and the next election in September 2026, is I will ensure that it is well publicised in your local communities and indeed in your schools that you have the ability to vote from the age of 16.
Supplementary, Ms. Jenkins.
A strong sense of community includes knowing the land we live on, caring for its future and understanding our cultural and ecological inheritance. Could the Minister confirm if his plans will continue include strengthening young people's connections to the natural environment, including protection of our Manx landscape and language?
Chief Minister to reply.
I think that's absolutely vital that we all recognise the value of the landscape that we have here on our island and the very many different opportunities that we have to protect that landscape. One of the initiatives that we have followed, Mr. President, is putting young people, two young champions actually, onto our biosphere board, and those two young people go out and promote the work of the biosphere board and stakeholder group in the broader community. And of course, I know through very much through the educational process, young people are given the opportunity to, I think, have a greater understanding of the environment and its impact more broadly on society and in terms of our future as humans on the planet. So absolutely, it remains very much at the heart of what we're doing as an island, and can be seen very much through the policies we're pursuing, and of course I hope through initiatives like such as the Young Champions that we promote through the Biosphere Stakeholder Group, that the young people are having a chance to actively engage in what is actually, of course, their future.
Move on to question two. Call on the Honourable Member for Douglas South, Mr. Connell.
Thank you, Mr. President. Is the current law on capital gains tax of net benefit to the island's economy?
Call on the Member for Otasti, Treasury, to reply.
Thank you, Mr. President. I thank the Honourable Member for the question. Capital gains tax is levied on profits made from the sale of assets that are not being traded. The capital gain is said to accrue when an asset appreciates in value and is realised when the asset is sold. The OECD, or the Organisation for Economic Cooperation and Development, is an international organisation that works to foster economic growth, improve living standards, and promote sustainable development among its member countries. It serves as a forum for governments to share experiences, identify best practices, and develop common policy standards. Most OECD countries tax capital gains more favourably than other forms of income to support economic growth, mitigate the lock-in effect whereby taxpayers hold their assets until they die, address double taxation of business income, and avoid taxing inflationary gains. This favourable treatment also helps manage large capital gains that could push taxpayers into higher tax brackets and achieve policy goals like promoting home ownership. As you can see, taxing capital gains has many complexities, which is why so many countries provide favourable treatment. In March 2024, Tyndall Court considered, debated, and received the 24 to 2026 tax strategy. The tax strategy clearly states that the Treasury will not introduce new taxes on capital. Taxes on capital gains would be a significant change to the Isle of Man's tax system and would not be in keeping with the island's planned aim to make the island a more attractive and prosperous place to live and work. No assessment has therefore been made as to the revenue which could be generated from such a tax, or for the adverse impact on the revenues from the island's existing taxes of such a significant change to the island's tax system. Thank you, Mr. President.
Supplementary, Ms. Kane.
Thank you, Mr. President. Can the Minister say categorically that capital gains tax will not be introduced by this government? As wouldn't it be fairer to tax the wealthiest rather than increasing income tax, which has a bigger impact on working families?
Member for Treasury to reply.
Thank you, Mr. President, and I thank the Member for that question. It is important for the Isle of Man that our tax system remains attractive in order to maintain the island's competitiveness as a place to live, work and carry out businesses and support both economic growth and sustainable government revenues. As the island does not have an asset-based or capital tax regime, the Income Tax Division does not systematically collect or hold the data through domestic tax returns, for example, capturing the disposal proceeds and acquisition cost information of capital transactions or the value of a person's personal assets, such as bank deposits, property, or insurance and pension plans, to assess the impact of the introduction of such taxes. For example, in the 2024-25 tax year, capital gains tax, CGT, contributed to a relatively small portion of the UK's national income. Total UK tax revenue was £858 billion. Capital gains tax revenue estimated about £17 billion. The UK GDP in 24-25 was approximately £2.35 trillion. This means that capital gains tax raised about 0.72% of UK GDP. Whilst capital gains tax is a notable source of revenue,
it represents a small fraction of the overall tax take. For comparison, in the UK, income tax, national insurance and capital gains tax combined accounted for 57% total of tax receipts. VAT and business tax contributed about 21% and 10% respectively.
Move on to question three. I call on the Honourable Member for Douglas East, Ms Beggs.
Thank you, Mr President. What plans does the government have to secure the future of the family library?
Call on Shaveshoki Conceal, Minister for Cabinet Office, to reply.
Thank you, Mr President. At the June sitting of Tynwald, a motion was approved requiring the Council and Ministers urgently work with the Family Library and Mobile Library Services to understand their financial and operating position, with due consideration given to maintaining continuity of service throughout the transition period and to bring forward options for October Tynwald with the objective of securing valued community services. In order to consider if and how government may support the services currently provided by the Family Library, it is essential to first understand the current financial position of the Family Library and any pressures that the current operators have been experiencing. In this respect, Treasury have recently met with representatives from the company that currently operates the library, the Family Library Limited, and also the Friends of the Family Library. Once the required information is received, the position understood, and the future options considered, the Council of Ministers will determine its policy position and return with a report to Tynwald in October.
Supplementary, Ms Williams.
Thank you, Mr President. How would the closure of the library affect childhood literacy rates?
Minister to reply.
Thank you very much, Mr President. Nothing that we've seen actually shows that it would have an adverse effect on the literacy rate, because of course there are a multitude of other libraries around. The bigger impact will actually be on the rural areas of the island, particularly with the mobile library service, which is an integral part of the family library. One of the things from my own personal point of view that the family library offers is more community-based services. So, for instance, my own daughter has attended the Sing and Sign lessons that have been going on at the family library, which have been invaluable for many families. And that is the sort of service that would get lost if the family library closes. So there is a commitment to government to go away and try and work with whoever may be in a position to take over the library to see what we can do to try and maintain.
Supplementary, Mr Bell.
Thank you, Mr President. Is there now valid reason for concern about the future of other community spaces on the island?
Minister to reply.
Thank you very much, Mr President. This is a rather unique position that the Family Library finds itself in. It is, of course, operated by a charity and has been since 2011. There has already been taxpayer funding put into the Family Library when I was Treasury Minister. And back in 2022, we agreed a five-year deal with the Family Library. That means that over the 5 years, they would receive funding of roughly around about £475,000. The purpose of that funding was to help them overcome their problems at that time and to try and increase fundraising. For whatever reason, that doesn't seem to have actually happened. And so they now find themselves in a position where they're losing £100,000 a year. We need to understand why that hasn't happened and what structurally is causing the problems before we can understand how to move forward. And that's why we'll be coming back with a full report to Tynwald in October to look at what we can do to try and maintain what, for some people, are essential services in our community.
Supplementary, Ms Woodhead.
Has the government looked at using the family library to help tackle the digital divide, especially for families without internet or devices in their homes?
Minister to reply.
Thank you very much, Mr President. Well, as I've said, this isn't, at the moment, it's run by a charity. It's completely independent. There are digital services available around the island in other library functions. So, for instance, I know Douglas Library, Onchan Library, and many of the other libraries actually offer access to digital services. I wouldn't think that specifically would be something that we'd look at with the family library, but it is something that I think we need to work with local authorities and other bodies to ensure, because you rightly say there are many people, Mr President, who are digitally excluded, to ensure that we can keep them included as society moves forward.
Supplementary, Ms Beggs.
Whilst you have said that the family library can offer services many other libraries and community spaces can offer, they offer bibliotherapy, they also offer sing and sign classes, crafts, and a very safe and warm space for young children and families, particularly after school. What would you say the impact of that would be by removing the family library as a service?
Minister to reply.
I'll be blunt about it. I think it would be very detrimental for certain areas of our community. I've mentioned I think it was in my second answer that my own daughter has used the Singing Sign classes, and we've found them as a family absolutely invaluable. So what is important is that we understand the situation with the family library, where their structural deficit is, why there is such a cost for the services, because when you actually look at the cost of their services compared to even bigger libraries, the costs do seem disproportionate. So we need to make a fundamental understanding of this, but what government has committed to is going away and looking at what we can do to see if we can save the family library, and in particular save those valuable community services such as the mobile library.
Moving on to question four, call on the Honourable Member for Onken, Ms Gerard.
In the Minister's opinion, is there a shortage of affordable housing, and if so, what plans are there to tackle this?
Call on Shabay Shoki Conceal, Minister for a Cabinet Office, to reply.
Thank you, Mr President, and thank you to the Honourable Member for the question on an important issue that concerns everyone on the island, but especially our younger generations. For the Member's information, on the island we define affordable housing as those occupied under the following mechanisms. So firstly, public sector rentals, so that's the DOI and local authorities. Secondly, the First Home Choice Shared Equity Purchase Assistance Scheme. And thirdly, the First Home Fixed Shared Equity Purchase Assistance Scheme. We commissioned an objective assessment of housing need last year, which tells us that the island needs additional affordable housing to match our increasing population. In December 2024, in response to this assessment, Tynwald agreed to a policy commitment to enable 1,000 more affordable homes between April 2025 and April 2035. Mr President, my colleague, the Minister for Infrastructure, announced in April this year to Tynwald the creation of a housing agency within the Department of Infrastructure to drive the building of affordable housing. Its full plans are yet to be announced, but work will get underway this year to develop a number of affordable properties on the Ballacubbin site in Colby, and scoping has begun on development of Crossag Farm in Ballasalla. For those wishing to buy on the private market, work is already ongoing to reform the shared equity purchase assistance schemes to enhance the level of support for first-time buyers. Work will be progressed on this by the end of the year.
Supplementary, Ms Evans.
What guarantee can the Minister give for younger people that the government will reach its proposed target for 1,000 homes, considering it failed to last year?
Minister to reply.
This is a new target, and it's actually the very first time that any administration has actually set a target. While there's been talk across many different administrations around affordable housing, this is the first time that any government in Manx history has actually turned around and said, we will aim this target. The pipeline at the moment is looking promising. Between now and the end of this administration, we look like we will hit that target. Then the year after this administration, in 2027, there's 122 in the pipeline. And even as far into 2028, there's actually, the pipeline's currently on 84, so is already coming towards the target. The assessment of housing need clearly showed that we do need to meet that target, that the 1,000 is the minimum we have to build over those 10 years. And this administration certainly is committed to it, and I would hope that the next administration will be as well.
Supplementary, Ms Kane.
Can the Minister offer any reassurance that there will be measures in place to ensure that first-time buyers and lower-income residents are able to purchase these affordable properties, and that investors looking to make a profit would be prevented from doing so?
Minister to reply.
Thank you, Mr President. Under the existing rules, investors are unable to purchase first-time buyer properties. They are literally that for people purchasing for the first time, so you can't have companies or other entities buying up those particular properties. It must be individuals and, you know, either families or single individuals, depending upon the property type. That is something that we will commit to, because it is the policy at the moment.
Supplementary, Ms Jenkins.
Can the Minister agree that the lack of affordable housing is driving young Manx people off the island in particular, and advising what steps he is taking to ensure that they are not priced out of living in their own island?
Minister to reply.
This is exactly, Mr President, why the administration has gone down the route that it has, in recognising that need. One of the things I've said very clearly and very publicly is, you know, it is becoming harder for young people to be able to purchase properties on the island. But also equally, not just the Honourable Member quite rightly mentioned about driving young people off the island, but it's also the other side as well. Young people who after university may wish to return to the island, in some cases are finding it quite hard to actually be able to come back and live within their means. So it is absolutely crucial that we actually get this right. and that we ensure that there is appropriate housing available at an appropriate price for people to be able to purchase.
Supplementary, Ms. Melinda.
As well as affordable housing, are there any future goals for median price ranges of housing being built intended for second or third time buyers?
Minister to reply.
So one of the things that has been potentially looked at but it needs scoping out is in relation to secondary buyers, because the UK particularly in their market is seeing an issue now where you've got people who may have been first time buyers, but because of the price differential for the next step up, they're stuck where they are in terms of if they actually need to expand housing because of their family. So that is something that we do need to look at as part of our housing policy, what we do, what you might term, and in the UK term, is next steppers, to see what we can actually do to support them. One of the issues, personally, I've always had with housing policy is in the past, it's been very easy for housing policy to be looked at in isolation. So you look at first-time buyers over here, you look at social housing over there, you look at retirement housing in a separate sort of circle. The actual truth is they all interlink, and you need to ensure that you have the policies joined up, because by even going the other stage and actually building housing for those who might want to downsize in later life, you then free up housing stock for people in different age groups. So it's important that we actually have a joined up housing policy, and that's what this administration is seeking to deliver.
Final supplementary, Ms. Perry.
I'd like to ask the Honourable Member whether these 1,000 homes were accounted for and the building of them and the financing of them was accounted for at the beginning of the budget session for this year.
Minister to reply.
Thank you, Mr. President. The way the financing works is it works on schemes coming forward, so it doesn't account for everything running right through, because we don't know where the pipeline is going to come from. So as schemes come forward, they will then start to appear in the Pink Book and will be approved by Treasury on a rolling basis.
Moving on to question 5, a call on the Honourable Member for Douglas Central, Ms. Williams.
To the Minister of Education, Sport and Culture, I want to ask whether, in her opinion, the island is becoming increasingly diverse. What measures are in place in her department schools to protect Manx culture, and what plans her department has for compulsory Manx Gaelic lessons?
Call on the Member for Insy Sport and Culture to reply.
Jeremiah Dectoran, I'd like to thank the Honourable Member for Douglas Central for her question. Schools on the Isle of Man enjoy the freedom to develop curricula which are relevant to the needs and interests of their pupils. This allows us all to celebrate both the diversity of students on the island whilst also appreciating the strong traditions and culture of the island. Protecting Manx culture is important to the department, and in fact one of our strategic priorities is to support settings to develop responsible, respectful, active citizens who contribute positively to local, national and global society. Primary schools include a range of Manx topics on their links, such as Celts and Vikings, the Victorians, coastal erosion, rivers, myths and legends, Manx politics, Manx music and dance. Manx culture-based training is provided currently on an online format for all teachers new to the island and includes information on our politics, history, Manx language in the classrooms and curriculums. Secondary schools link Manx heritage and culture where they can in their history curriculums available on the individual websites. They also link exam coursework and syllabus to the island, for example, Victorian tourism in the Isle of Man and geography fieldwork. In the Isle of Man, there's also one primary school, Bunscoil Gaelic, which offers immersion learning of Manx, and one secondary school that currently offers two subjects per year taught through Manx to fluent speaking pupils in Key Stage 3. The department delivers Manx into primary and secondary schools island-wide through a central Manx language service. There are currently no plans to make Manx compulsory. Gurumai Dectoran.
Supplementary, Mr. Malloy.
Thank you, Mr. President. Our sister language in Irish has seen that use of the language in schools has caused burnout amongst its young people, and that true growth in the language's usage has come from popular culture through various musical acts spoken in their language. So I ask the Minister what plans she has to make the Manx language more appealing through natural means to our young people.
Member Education to reply.
You're my Deputy Rem. We're very fortunate on the Isle of Man to have a thriving Manx community, and actually we have the Manx Folk Awards that is sponsored by the Department of Education, Sport and Culture, and so we are very keen to ensure that Manx is not just seen as a nice to have, but actually is part of our cultural identity, and really it's part of everything that we do. In fact, you hear Manx being spoken within our Parliament today, and hopefully that is something that you'll take back to your schools and continue to embed within your own day-to-day practices.
Supplementary, Miss Williams.
Following the retirement of the head teacher of the Bun School Gilgag, what would be the potential implications of an executive head teacher who is unlikely to be fluent in Manx Gaelic on the important establishment?
Member to reply.
You're my Director N. The department is working closely with the parents and the other teachers of the Bun School Gaelic at the moment to find a solution that both works for them and for the young people. It's very important that our cultural identity and Manx language is delivered as part of the curriculum within the Manx school, and so we are working very closely with the teachers and the parents and the young people of the school to ensure that we can provide that service still.
Supplementary, Ms Beggs of Legislative Council.
If Manx Gaelic lessons remain non-compulsory, what does the department believe the consequences will be for the future of the language and Manx culture on the island?
Member to reply.
Good morning, Director N. Like we've already said, it isn't compulsory. However, Manx Studies does continue to flourish through the huge emphasis on local communities within Manx schools and their will and commitment to celebrate the strong traditions and culture of our island. In fact, if anybody went down to Timwell Day this past Monday, you will see that everybody was out enjoying the Manx culture and what we have on the island, and we are very, very, very lucky to have what we do have, and the department does their part to ensure that those strong traditions continue well into the future. Gurumai Director N.
Moving on to question 6, I call on the Honourable Member for Rushen, Ms Karush.
I would ask the Minister for Education, Sport and Culture whether she is satisfied with the provision of subject specialists and educational resources in her department's schools. And if not, what are you doing to improve this?
Member for INSEE Sport and Culture to reply.
Schools know what skills they need to deliver their provision, and whenever possible, recruit subject specialists as they deem necessary. Schools also need to be flexible with their staffing, and it may sometimes be the case that teachers are teaching in their second subject for a proportion of their timetable. Schools will ensure that exam classes for Key Stage 4 and 5 classes are taught by the specialists that they have available to them. Where specialists are not available or not available in sufficient numbers, collaboration arrangements can help to ensure that specialist knowledge is made available to all our learners. Whilst the teacher recruitment landscape can be challenging, I am satisfied that we are doing everything possible to secure teachers within the skills and knowledge required to support students on their learning journey. In terms of resources in schools, head teachers manage their budgets and make decisions about which resources they require and how best to invest their budgets for the benefit of the young people in their schools. Gurumai Director N.
Supplementary, Mr Bell.
Castle Rushen High School recently advertised for a teacher to teach and be familiar with specifications and curriculum requirements for geography, history, English, music, global perspectives and health and social care at Key Stage 3 and 4. Their specifications alone would rival war and peace. This may not be specialisation, but how can a teacher provide the relative education in not only 4 but 6 different subjects?
Member to reply.
This isn't an uncommon problem that we have, unfortunately, and this is why we mentioned the challenges that we do have with attracting teachers to the island. So the department is doing its very best to be able to provide incentivization for people to come to the island to teach. What we do have is that schools are accustomed to changing the demands and the trends to take on two main option points of Year 9 and 11. Ordinarily, schools will know in advance which subjects that they can resource and have the staffing to deliver. So your specific example there mentioned a teacher who has to deliver lessons to a wide range of subjects. And although that's not ideal, the school have spoke with the teacher to try and make allowances for that to be successful for the young people.
Supplementary, Mr. Malloy.
Thank you, Mr. President. Where specialists aren't available, students often have to travel between multiple school sites in order to take part in all their chosen lessons, including many who have to do this to go for the university courses they want to. What plans does the government have to introduce these specialists where they are necessary and to make it easier for students to actually attend all the lessons they wish to?
Member to reply.
Good morning, Dr. Wren. Our plan would be to continue to try and incentivise teachers to come to the Isle of Man. So we have on the Isle of Man, we have a different pay scale to the UK. We try and make it as attractive as possible to work on the island. But until that point, we do have collaboration that works quite successfully between the different schools. We have the opportunity then for young people to be able to learn different experiences and to gain knowledge and learning from other schools and from other teachers. So, yes, we do have collaboration that commonly is part of what we have to provide. But ideally, we'd have more people come to the Isle of Man to teach our young people and help them thrive.
Supplementary, Miss Kane.
Does the Minister believe we will ever have a quality of subject offered at all secondary schools, especially at A-level, rather than the current postcode lottery that Douglas students have an increased range of subject choices compared to the rest of the island?
Yeah. Member to reply.
So I think the Honourable Member is asking me, will we continue to provide a good quality education for our sixth form students if demands continue to be a problem? Is that the question?
Would you like to clarify,
Sorry.
Please?
To clarify, I'm asking whether there will ever be equality over A-level subjects between schools in the north that often have to travel to several different schools or potentially even move to do the subjects they want to do.
Member to reply.
We do rely on our head teachers to allocate the resource that they have available to try to decide what that school requires and what those young people require. If the Northern School head teachers have made that decision to allocate the staffing how they have, that really is a decision for them, and that would be something that the department would instruct them to do differently.
Supplementary, Ms Perry.
I'd like to ask the Honourable Member for any data or figures that you may have regarding the effectiveness of the incentivisation that you've offered to teachers.
Member to reply.
I don't have that data with me today, however I'm happy to circulate that past after the sitting if we have it available. I think what we do have is we have a very committed workforce on the island that come here and they find a great work-life balance, something that they don't have in the UK. And we also have a quality assurance framework on the Isle of Man which looks to positively harbour relationships between teachers so they can advance their learning and their teaching skills so for the betterment of the young people, which is far different to the UK where they have an INSET system, Ofsted system, which is more about attributing sort of negative connotations to their practices. However, on the Isle of Man, we are all more about working more collaboratively together for the betterment of our young people. So I would say that the Isle of Man does have a better regime. We do have a more holistic view for our teachers and our young people, and that does mean we have people who continue to work with us for a long time. But yeah, it's just trying to get those teachers to come here in the first place and incentivise them to do so and to stay here. And that involves including lots of different policy options as well, not just responsibility for the Department of Education, Sport and Culture.
Supplementary, Ms Beggs.
Alongside staffing, what is being implemented to ensure quality education that's equal across all schools, particularly in exam years, is provided?
Member to reply.
Gurumai Dr. Wren, I think this goes back to the point that I raised within my answer, which is that the schools know best how to deliver the provision, and wherever possible they will try and recruit the specialist. However, we do need to rely on some teachers to do more than one subject, and we're very grateful for them to do so. Thank you, Dr. Wren.
Final supplementary, Ms Weldon.
What is currently being done to incentivise teachers to move over to the island? Not only that, but also to keep them here on a long-term scale?
Member to reply.
So the Department of Education, Sport and Culture plays a huge part actually in incentivising the young people, the teachers to come to the Isle of Man by creating a safer and more holistic place to work. We also require cross-government policy changes as well to be able to make that possible. So if we have teachers who are caregivers, for example, we need to make sure that we have child-friendly policies in place so that when people come here with their families, that they can integrate into the community easier and feel at home. So this isn't just an issue for the Department of Education, Sport and Culture. It is a cross-government problem that we have in recruiting and retaining our key members of the community, not only for within teaching, but obviously within the other very important sectors that we need to have on our island.
Moving on to question 7, call on the Honourable Member for Rushen, Ms Woodhead.
I'd like to ask the Minister for Education, Sport and Culture how her department intends to monitor and regulate the use of artificial intelligence in her schools.
Member for INSEE Sport and Culture to reply.
And I'd like to thank the member for her question. Digital technologies and their application in education are a continually evolving landscape. We must safeguard our students and staff while preserving their academic integrity and future-proof them in terms of the knowledge and skills that will serve them effectively into the future. AI has experienced remarkable progress within a relatively short time frame, presenting positive outcomes such as advancements in medical diagnosis and improvements in software design. However, as with any technological advancement, there are inherent challenges that we will diligently monitor and regulate. The implementation of access restrictions ensures the monitoring and regulating of utilisation of AI in educational settings. Government-approved AI software is accessible on government and school networks. We have provided teachers with access to the latest AI checkers to verify the authenticity of student work. This checker is identical to the one utilised by exam boards to ensure the originality of student submissions. With examinations, each exam board has regulations on what the misuse of AI looks like for examinations and coursework. It is important that we don't shy away from incorporating the use of AI in education. However, we need to ensure it is safe and appropriate and this is incorporated into our curriculum.
Supplementary, Ms Thompson.
Could the Minister please clarify what are the safeguards that are in place to ensure the protection of students' data and if AI tools are being used behind the scene currently?
Member to reply.
I think the question was how do we monitor it? So we have AI checkers for safeguarding? Can we just get a clarification?
Supplementary, Mr Hickey. Oh, thank you, partner. It was a clarification.
It was just how are you safeguarding over the students' data currently?
Member to reply.
So we personally, as the department, don't hold that data. That data is within the software that we have, the software that we signed up to, which is not just for us, but it's also the government-wide software.
Supplementary, Mr. Hickey.
Thank you, Mr. President. With AI having many good uses as a revision tool within schools, and also many negative uses, such as completing coursework for students, would the Minister not support incorporating AI into the life skills curriculum within schools?
Member to reply.
You're my Director N. I think that's a very valid question and something that I will take back to the department to discuss. Go Amide.
Move on to question 8. Call on the Honourable Member for Arbury Castlemaloe, Ms Jenkins.
How will the government's environmental and energy policies support and protect biodiversity?
Call on Shaveshak Tomaltak B as Innes to reply.
Thank you, Mr President, and thank you to the Honourable Member for her question. The government's environmental and energy policies are set out in a number of documents, including the Island Plan, Climate Change Plan, Energy Strategy, Strategic Plan, and Biodiversity Strategy, to name just a few. One of the biggest threats to biodiversity is acknowledged to be climate change, which is resulting in rising temperatures, changing rainfall patterns, extreme weather events, and ocean acidification, putting pressure on species already threatened by other human activities. Recent international findings show that a rapid transition to renewable energy is dramatically better for nature, human health, and jobs. Therefore, it is important that energy policies assist in protecting biodiversity, which is why the Isle of Man government energy policy is to increase our energy independence and security through on-island renewables and carbon-neutral energy generation. We have committed to decarbonising our power system to net zero emissions by 2030. DEFA also seeks to protect and improve biodiversity and habitats using a variety of statutory protected sites, including areas of special scientific interest, marine nature reserves, and Ramsar sites. Applications for development, including those for energy projects, are considered against policies which seek to minimise or improve environmental impact, including biodiversity. For large developments, information regarding biodiversity, amongst a number of other issues, are required to be part of a formal environmental impact assessment, which is an integral part of the planning process.
Supplementary, Ms. Jenkins.
Can the Minister advise why her department has not yet introduced a statutory nature positive duty in its climate and energy planning, as recommended by the United Nations and included in international best practice?
Very sharp Minister to reply.
Thank you very much, and in fact this is one of the areas that we are currently working towards. It sits within our climate change plan and within our department plan, and our intention is to introduce such a duty.
Supplementary, Ms. Thompson.
Can the Minister just confirm if the Isle of Man will create legally protected zones where energy is permanently excluded for the sake of biodiversity?
Minister to reply.
Thank you. As I said before, any energy development is absolutely required to go through the formal planning process. And within that process, certain sites do have specific protections, which I outlined, such as the Ramsar sites, marine nature reserves, areas of special scientific interest. Those are treated with a specific approach because of legislative requirement and statutory protection. But the environmental impact assessment then seeks to review every site for any development across the island to ensure that all of the considerations are taken fully into account and appropriate decisions made.
Supplementary, Ms. Jenkins.
Does the Minister accept that government policy risks undermining biodiversity protection even when pursuing climate goals like the Care Ride?
Minister to reply.
Thank you. I'm unable to comment on any site-specific applications or future applications. However, I would reaffirm my commitment to the planning process and the environmental impact assessment. I would encourage anyone who has a specific interest in any site to engage fully with that process once it commences.
Yeah. Supplementary, Ms. Weldon.
Has the island status as a UNESCO biosphere affected its policy on environment and climate change?
Minister to reply.
Thank you. The UNESCO Biosphere Reserve status covers a plethora of things, from environment to education, research and our economy, and it very much incorporates how we as humans interact with our environment. So it really is a wider thing than the environment. But the environment does cover us in terms of our terrestrial and marine areas that cover our core, our care, and those peripheral areas then. And we're currently in the review process in that regard for our periodic review for our biosphere status, where we will consider whether we should be changing, expanding those core areas, those protected areas. And we often find that those are in line with those designations I talked about previously, such as ASSIs, Ramsar sites, and marine nature reserves. So absolutely, there is an interaction in that regard.
Moving on to question 9, a call on the Honourable Member for Middle, Mr. Koroma.
Thank you, President. To what extent is the island ready to provide a greener future? And if not, when will the necessary recycling and renewable energy resources be provided? Thank you.
On Chavesha, Komaltak B. Azinis to reply.
Thank you, Mr. President. Thank you again to the Honourable Member for his question. The Isle of Man Government is committed to a greener future and is actively working towards making that a reality. In 2023, the UK's ratification of the Paris Agreement, an international treaty on tackling climate change, was extended to the Isle of Man. The principles of sustainable development are core to our biosphere status and have been embedded in government decision-making processes via the Climate Impact Assessment, which takes into account a range of environmental, social and economic criteria. The Isle of Man Climate Change Plan 2022 to 2027 sets out climate actions across all sectors, including a commitment to deliver at least 20 megawatts of locally generated renewable electricity by 2026 and 100% of our electricity from carbon neutral sources by 2030. Our energy strategy reconfirms these commitments, and we're currently working towards a more detailed timeline for delivery. Curbside waste collection is organised by local authorities rather than central government, but recycling banks and other routes for recycling are available across the island. Currently, over 50% of the 244,713 tonnes of waste generated in 2024 was recycled, and a further 20% was incinerated at the energy from waste plant to generate electricity. Recycling is a key element of waste management, and we are working closely with DOI as they develop their waste strategy. Environmental, social and economic sustainability are key to the future health and well-being of our island, our community and the wider world.
Supplementary, Ms. Kenner.
Will outstanding liabilities inherited by Manx Utilities and old MEA loans limit our ability to transition away from our fossil-fuelled electricity generation?
I appreciate, obviously, that funding structures within MEA have been a topic of a lot of conversation. However, the current funding for the future projects for the MU have been addressed. We have obviously had consolidation work against previous loans, and from my perspective, I think it's really important that we do not allow historic chapters, I suppose, of our playbook to prevent us making progress that's really important in terms of our energy changes for the island. However, we must absolutely learn from mistakes that were made.
Supplementary, Ms. Woodhead.
Have you looked at introducing low emission zones like some of the big cities in the UK and how that might impact our emissions on the island?
Minister to reply.
Thank you. So we haven't looked at low emission zones on the basis of some of the preliminary air pollution monitoring we've done indicating that actually we don't have the zones that would have the higher emissions that have been seen in other cities that have introduced those. However, I think that there is a number of pieces of work that colleagues in Department of Infrastructure are looking at in terms of how we might better manage the flow of traffic in different areas and specifically around schools and residential areas that I think will be important in that consideration.
Supplementary, Ms. Jenkins.
Given the importance of protecting our countryside and biodiversity, can the Minister explain why the Government continues to prioritise industrial onshore wind turbines rather than investing in smaller scale renewables, rooftop solar or improving energy efficiency in homes?
Minister to reply.
Thank you. And the Government commissioned a number of reports in this space, which are all published online and available for anyone to look through, which clearly state that onshore wind is the most cost-efficient way for government to deploy onshore energy at scale, and in fact against offshore energy that was considered as well in offshore wind. However, we do also have a 10 megawatt program around onshore solar that the government are pursuing, and that is looking at a number of opportunities, whether that be on top of buildings, which does have its own challenges in terms of the actual physical infrastructure and doing the appropriate assessments prior to being able to deploy that, and also looking at other options around where solar may exist. We're also currently doing a study around biomass, looking at how we might stabilise grids, and also looking at how we can support the private sector in terms of some of their energy generation programmes to allow that to be part of our wider energy generation across the island. So there's a number of different programmes. This isn't just onshore wind, but if you look at all the statistics, that is the one that comes out time and again as being the most suitable solution for an island of our demographics and our energy usage.
Supplementary, Ms. Beggs.
Lots of improvements and sustainable strategies for the future depend on young people. What's being done to make them more aware of their future and their environment?
Minister to reply.
Thank you. There's a number of different things that are being done and supported by the teams from within DEFA. So there was a Green Summit was held last Friday, I believe, at Ballacamine High School. I popped along just at the beginning of that. Unfortunately, I wasn't able to stay, but I'm hoping to be able to go in future because I'd seen the agenda and it looked really actually quite interesting. I know we've also had our climate change teams have gone out to events within schools, also community events, where they've been able to talk to young people and really have had a focus of that in their engagement piece. So it's absolutely a key tenet if you look through our commitments, through the Paris Agreement, through other conventions that we've signed up to, but also with our climate change plan, that we engage with the community, and that needs to include all parts of the community. And in terms of sustainability, that then crosses into the biosphere work, which sustainability sits at the heart of that, where we do have our two youth representatives. They have been instrumental in commencing a UK and Europe youth Man in the Biosphere Forum, which is really a brilliant opportunity for the Isle of Man to start to tell its story on a more global stage. And we also have just commenced the new Biosphere Board, and we have made one of the explicit seats that will be at that table, regardless of who future representatives may be on the Stakeholder Partnership Board, but there will be a youth representative sitting at that board. So we absolutely are committed to making sure that the youth voice is heard in those spaces.
And supplementary, Ms. Kane.
Does the Minister believe that the recycling of newspapers should be brought back, potentially with some promotion to increase tonnage recycled, over the current situation of them being processed at the incinerator?
Minister to reply.
Thank you. So my understanding is that newspapers were only removed from the centralised bring bank, so they are still being widely recycled. Certainly I'm recycling my newspapers in my curbside boxes through Douglas Council. What I think is clear is there is a disparity across the Isle of Man, and there isn't a consistency as to who can and cannot recycle different items. I appreciate that living in Douglas, I'm very fortunate in that regard, and we have an extensive curbside recycling offering in Douglas. That is not the case, I know, across the island. And one of the things that is being looked at more broadly across the waste strategy is how we support the incentivisation of that across all local authorities.
That was the first 50 minutes of Junior Tynwald Question Time. So what do you think? Were the politicians answering the questions less cautious in their answers compared with Senior Tynwald sittings? What role do you think Junior Tynwald plays in encouraging young people to engage with Manx politics? Well, there's more of Junior Tynwald on tomorrow's agenda, including interviews with some of the students who took part. Well worth a listen, I think. Don't forget, this programme is available as a podcast on Manx Radio's website. I'm Phil Gawne. Goedemorgen, Geisachrom. Thanks for listening.